robust public forum where individuals can use the rule of reason to hold government accountable. Our opinions on good and evil are interpreted through the Nielsen ratings. Even worse, according to Jane Mayer of The New Yorker, DVDs of 24 have become widely popular among U.S. troops stationed in Iraq. Mayer quoted a former Army interrogator, Tony Lagaranas, as saying, "People watch the shows and then walk into the interrogation booths and do the same things they've just seen." The abhorrent acts at Abu Ghraib and elsewhere were a direct consequence of the culture of impunity, encouraged, authorized, and instituted by Bush and Rumsfeld in their statements that the Geneva Conventions did not apply. These kinds of horrific abuses were the logical, inevitable outcome of policies and statements from the administration. To me, just as glaring as the evidence of the pictures themselves was the revelation that it was established practice for prisoners to be moved around during the visits of the International Committee of the Red Cross so they would not be available for interviews. No one can claim that was the act of a few bad apples. That was policy set from above with a direct intent to violate U.S. values that the administration was claiming to uphold. This was the kind of policy that we see and criticize in places like China and Cuba. Moreover, the administration now has also set up the men and women of our own armed forces for payback the next time they are held as prisoners. For that, the administration should be held responsible. It is now clear that the abuses of the truth and the unforgivable abuse of trust after 9/11 led to the problems in the prison, and we are now learning that there were similar problems in many other facilities constructed as part of the Bush administration's network of secret prison camps, in which, according to the Red Cross, between 70% and 90% of the people are innocent of any wrongdoing. What would Thomas Jefferson think of the curious and discredited argument from our current Justice Department that the president may authorize what plainly amounts to the torture of prisoners, and that any law or treaty that attempts to constrain his treatment of prisoners in time of war would itself be a violation of the Constitution? It is deeply disturbing that the administration so frequently uses the word dominance to describe its strategic goals. It is disturbing because an American policy of dominance is as repugnant to the rest of the world as the ugly pictures of those helpless naked Iraqi prisoners being so dominated has been to the people of our country. Dominance is as dominance does. Dominance is not really a strategic policy or political philosophy at all. Rather, it is a seductive illusion that tempts the powerful to satiate their hunger for still more power by striking a bargain with their consciences. And as always happens sooner or later to those who shake hands with the devil, they find out too late that what they have given up in the bargain is their soul. One of the clearest indications of the impending loss of intimacy with one's soul is the failure to recognize the existence of the soul in those over whom power is being exercised, especially if the helpless come to be dehumanized and treated as animals and degraded. It has been especially shocking and awful to see these evils perpetrated so crudely and cruelly in the name of the United States of America. Those pictures of torture and sexual abuse came to us embedded in a wave of news about escalating casualties and growing chaos enveloping our entire policy in Iraq. But in order to understand the failure of our overall policy, I believe it is important to focus specifically on what exactly happened in Abu Ghraib prison and ask whether or not those actions were representative of who we are as Americans. As noted, many of these captives have reportedly died while being tortured by executive branch interrogators, and many more have been broken and humiliated. In the notorious Abu Ghraib prison itself, investigators who documented the pattern of torture estimated that more than 90% of the victims were innocent of any charges. This shameful exercise of power overturns a set of principles that our nation has observed since General Washington first enunciated them during our Revolutionary War and has been observed by every president since then, until now. These practices violate the Geneva Conventions and the United Nations Convention Against Torture, not to mention our own laws against torture. In fact, following World War II, the U.S. government prosecuted foreign soldiers for waterboarding American troops. The president has also claimed that he has the authority to deliver captives under our control for imprisonment and interrogation on our behalf by autocratic regimes in nations that are infamous for the cruelty of their techniques for torture. Can it be true that any president really has such powers under our Constitution? If the answer is yes, then under the theory by which these acts are committed, are there any acts that can on their face be prohibited? If the president has the inherent authority to eavesdrop, imprison citizens on his own declaration, kidnap, and torture, then what can't he do? After analyzing the executive branch's claims of these previously unrecognized powers, Harold Coe, dean of Yale Law School, said, "If the president has commander-in-chief power to commit torture, he has the power to commit genocide, to sanction slavery, to promote apartheid, to license summary execution." The principal alternative to democracy throughout history has been the consolidation of virtually all state power in the hands of a single strongman or small group that together exercises that power without the informed consent of the governed. It was in revolt against just such a regime, after all, that America was founded. When Lincoln declared at the time of our greatest crisis that the ultimate question being decided in the Civil War was whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure, he was not only saving our Union, but also recognizing the fact that democracies are rare in history. And when they fail, as did Athens and the Roman Republic, upon whose designs our founders drew heavily, what emerges in their place is another strongman regime. The top-heavy focus on dominance as a goal for the U.S. role in the world is exactly paralleled by this administration's aspiration for the role of the president to completely dominate our constitutional system. The goal of dominance necessitates a focus on power, even absolute power. The administration has also launched an assault on the right of the courts to review its actions, on the right of the Congress to have information on how the public's money is being spent, on the right of the news media to have information about the policies that it is pursuing, and on anyone who criticizes its excesses. This instinct, in turn, has also led them to introduce a new level of viciousness in partisan politics. It was that which led to the attacks labeling Senator Max Cleland, who lost three limbs during the Vietnam War, as unpatriotic. This same pattern characterizes virtually all of the Bush administration's policies. It resents any constraint as an insult to its will to dominate and to exercise power, and its appetite for power is astonishing. The drive to consolidate power in the name of national security is an old story, and the consequences of that drive today are all too familiar to history, as we will see in more detail in the following chapter. Chapter 6. National Insecurity. Newton's third law states, "For every action force, there is an equal and opposite reaction force." National security policy is very different from physics, but the principles of logic and reason turn out to be useful and relevant there, too. And something like Newton's third law does seem to be a reality in international relations. When any nation is seen as trying to dominate others, there is a reaction force that pushes back. The pursuit of dominance in foreign policy led the Bush administration to ignore the United Nations, to do serious damage to our most important alliances, to violate international law, and to cultivate the hatred and contempt of many in the rest of the world. The seductive appeal of exercising unconstrained unilateral power led this president to interpret his powers under the Constitution in a way that brought to life the worst nightmare of the founders. Any policy based on domination of the rest of the world not only creates enemies for the United States and creates recruits for al-Qaeda, but also undermines the international cooperation that is essential to defeating terrorists who wish to harm and intimidate America. Instead of dominance, we should be seeking preeminence in a world where nations respect us and seek to follow our leadership and adopt our values. Unilateralism, as we have painfully seen in Iraq, is often its own reward. Going it alone may indulge a political instinct, but it is dangerous to our military, even without the commander-in-chief taunting terrorists to bring them on. And the kind of unilateral power President Bush and Vice President Cheney imagine is, in any case, a strategic El Dorado. Just as their pursuit in Iraq has led to tragic consequences for our troops and the Iraqi people, the pursuit of a new interpretation of the presidency that ends up weakening the Congress, the courts, and civil society is not good for either the presidency or the rest of the nation. If the Congress becomes an enfeebled enabler to the executive, and the courts become known for political calculations in their decisions, then the country suffers. Wise generals and admirals throughout history have understood the dangers of preparing to fight the last war rather than the next one. Wise nations, and until recently the United States was considered one, also understand the dangers of preparing to protect their national security only against old threats while ignoring new ones that are more dangerous. America's classic national security agenda was built upon common efforts to resist aggression and to stop armed conflict. During our first two centuries, we witnessed wars among nations and violence on the scale of war within nations for many reasons. Claims of religious, ideological, racial, or ethnic superiority have precipitated major conflicts throughout history. Poverty has caused the collapse of expectations and made people desperate and then open to demagogic appeals. Leaders have sometimes used aggression against their neighbors as a way of redirecting tensions inside their own countries. The lust for power has often resulted in expansion, violence, and aggression. But while the old threats still face our global community, there are new things under the sun, new forces arising that could soon challenge international order, raising issues of peace and war. What matters is that we find one of those precious few moments in all of human history when we have a chance to cause the change we wish to see in the world by seeking a common agreement to openly recognize a powerful new truth that has been growing just beneath the surface of every human heart. It is time to change the nature of the way we live together on this planet. From this new vantage point, we have an opportunity to forge and follow a new agenda for national and world security. First and foremost, our security is threatened by the global environmental crisis, which could render all our other progress meaningless unless we deal with it successfully. Already, the increase in severe droughts, severe flooding, and stronger storms is having a harsh impact. Second, there is a looming water crisis that reflects both the sharp growth in demand for fresh water, global warming's disruption of the natural storage system of mountain snowpacks and glaciers, and a decline in water quality owing to the effects of pollution and inadequate water treatment. Third, we must conquer the global challenge presented by terrorism, magnified by a growing access to new weapons of mass destruction. Fourth, the global challenge of defeating drugs and corruption, which now spill across our borders, has never been more serious given the growing strength and sophistication of international crime organizations. Fifth, new pandemics like HIV/AIDS are laying waste to whole societies, a problem compounded by the emergence of new strains of old diseases that are horrifyingly resistant to the antibiotics that protected the last three generations. We tend to think of threats to security in terms of war and peace. Yet no one can doubt that the havoc wreaked by HIV/AIDS threatens our safety. The heart of the security agenda is protecting lives, and we now know that the number of people who will die of AIDS in the first decade of the 21st century will rival the number that died in all the wars of the 20th century. When hundreds of people in sub-Saharan Africa are infected every hour of every day, when 15 million children have already become orphans and many must be raised by other children, when a single disease threatens everything from economic strength to peacekeeping, we clearly face a security threat of the greatest magnitude. Our task is not merely to recognize and confront these challenges, but to rise to our higher ideals. To succeed, we must create a world where people's faith in their own capacity for self-governance unlocks their potential and justifies their growing belief that all can share in an ever-widening circle of human dignity and self-sufficiency. As a world community, we must prove that we are wise enough to control what we have been smart enough to create. We must understand that the old conception of global security, with its focus almost solely on armies, ideologies, and geopolitics, has to be enlarged. We should pursue a new and broader national security agenda with determination, adequate resources, and creative use of the new tools at the world's disposal that can be used to bring us together in successful common efforts. Tools such as the internet and the emerging global information infrastructure, which, if used imaginatively, will enable new depths of insight and cooperation by nations, non-governmental organizations, and citizens at all levels. We should follow a policy of forward engagement, as Professor Leon Firth at George Washington University has advocated, and re-establish a robust role for reason in our analysis of and early engagement with the many strategic opportunities and dangers that we must anticipate in building a safer, more secure, and more civilized world for future generations. It is important to take hope from the large advances in human history, which we sometimes take for granted or see as having been inevitable. Slavery, for example, was once commonplace, and yet now is almost universally considered abhorrent and obsolete. Although remnants of this evil practice remain in hidden portions of the world, and although the word slavery is attached to related abhorrent practices like the abduction of women for the sex trades, there is no longer open institutionalized enslavement of one race of people by another on a massive scale as there was prior to the American Civil War. Centuries from now, many practices that we now take for granted will also be seen as having been completely self-defeating and absurd. But we are currently faced with the urgent task of accelerating our own psychological, emotional, intellectual, and spiritual evolution in order to see over the internal walls that may have served some useful purpose ages ago, but are now merely obstacles that prevent us from seeing the new path we must take. We need to show that we not only can contain aggression, prevent war, and mediate conflicts, but can work together to anticipate and respond to a new century with its new global imperatives. At this fateful juncture in our history, it is vital that we see clearly who and what our enemies are and how we intend to deal with them. It is also important, however, that in the process we preserve not only the physical safety of our people, but also our dedication to the rule of law. As a nation, our greatest export has always been the hope that through the rule of law, people can be free to pursue their dreams. We have hoped that democracy can supplant repression and that justice, not power, can be society's guiding force. With the blatant failure by the present U.S. government to respect the rule of law, we now face a great challenge in restoring America's moral authority in the world and demonstrating our commitment to bringing a better life to our global neighbors. We have reached a point where we hardly recognize our country when we look in the mirror. How could we have come to this point? Just as major corporations have come to recognize the value of the brands they are marketing to customers, so we as American citizens should recognize that there is great significance and value in whatever visceral opinions people throughout the world have when they hear or read the phrase United States of America. Our founders understood this in different words more than two centuries ago. Thomas Jefferson once wrote, "The good opinion of mankind, like the lever of Archimedes, with the given fulcrum, moves the world." Make no mistake, it is precisely our moral authority that is our greatest source of strength. It is precisely our moral authority that has been recklessly put at risk by the cheap calculations of this willful president. He wagered with history and put America's goodwill and good name at risk. He lost, and because our nation was made a hostage to his moral compromises, we all lost. The same troubling pattern characterizes the Bush-Cheney administration's approach to almost all national issues. In almost every policy area, the administration's consistent goal has been to eliminate any constraints, whether by law, regulation, alliance, or treaty, on their exercise of raw power. And in the process, it has caused America to be seen by the other nations of the world as holding contempt and disdain for the international community. The disdain that this administration demonstrates in its approach to all international agreements and treaties is similar to its contempt for rational debate based on reason and evidence in our national politics and public discourse. Rather than trusting that the international public forum can produce agreements that benefit all participants, the Bush-Cheney administration has an avowed foreign policy goal of unilateralism. Power is more important than compromise, and dominance is more important than international law. The Bush administration's objective of attempting to establish U.S. domination over any potential adversary was exactly what led to the hubristic, tragic miscalculation of the Iraq War. A painful misadventure marked by one disaster after another, based on one mistaken assumption after another. But the people who paid the price have been the American men and women in uniform trapped over there, and the Iraqis themselves. At the level of our relations with the rest of the world, the administration has willingly traded in respect for the United States in favor of fear. That was the real meaning of shock and awe. This administration has coupled its theory of American dominance with a doctrine of preemptive strikes, regardless of whether the threat to be preempted is imminent or not. George Tenet, director of the CIA from 1997 to 2004, made it clear that the agency never said Iraq was an imminent threat. For this administration, the threat to be preempted didn't have to be imminent. The new doctrine called preemption asserts a new, uniquely American right to preemptively attack whomever the president deems a potential future threat. It is based on the idea that in the era of proliferating weapons of mass destruction, and against the background of a sophisticated terrorist threat, the United States cannot wait for proof of an established mortal threat. It must act fast to cut the threat short. The problem with preemption is that, in the first instance, it is not needed in order to give the United States the means to act in our own defense, either against terrorism in general or against Iraq in particular. But that is a relatively minor issue compared with the longer-term consequences that I think can be foreseen for this doctrine. The doctrine is presented in open-ended terms, which means that Iraq is not necessarily the last application. In fact, the very logic of the concept suggests a string of military engagements against a succession of sovereign states. Syria, Libya, North Korea, Iran, none of them very popular in the United States, of course. But the implication is that wherever the combination exists of an interest in weapons of mass destruction, together with an ongoing role as host to or participant in terrorist operations, the doctrine will apply. It also means that the Iraq resolution created the precedent for preemptive action anywhere, whenever this or any future president decides that it is time. The risks of this preemption doctrine stretch far beyond the disaster in Iraq. This policy affects the basic relationship between the United States and the rest of the world. Article 51 of the United Nations Charter recognizes the right of any nation to defend itself, including the right to take preemptive action in order to deal with imminent threats. If other nations asserted the broader right to preemption that the Bush administration has, however, then the rule of law would quickly be replaced by the reign of fear. Under this approach, any nation that perceives circumstances that could eventually lead to an imminent threat would be justified in taking military action against another nation. In other words, President Bush initiated one of the most fateful military doctrines in history. He abandoned what we thought was America's mission in a world in which nations are guided by a common ethic codified in the form of international law. the consequences of an emerging national strategy that not only celebrates American strengths, but also appears to glorify the notion of dominance, could actually strengthen the very enemies we seek to defeat. If what America represents to the world is leadership in a commonwealth of equals in which we are preeminent, then our friends will be legion. But if what we represent to the world is empire, then it is our enemies who will be legion. Over 2 decades ago, the Soviet Union claimed the right to launch a preemptive war in Afghanistan. We properly encouraged and then supported Afghanistan's resistance movement, which a decade later forced the Soviet army to retreat and withdraw. Unfortunately, however, when the Russians left, we abandoned the Afghans, and the lack of any coherent nation-building program led directly to the conditions that allowed the Taliban to take control and give Al-Qaeda a home and a base for their worldwide terrorist operations. That's where they planned the 9/11 attacks. Incredibly, in spite of that vivid lesson, after defeating the Taliban rather easily, and despite pledges from President Bush that we would never again abandon Afghanistan, we have done precisely that in most of the country. Only a portion of the capital city has been secured. Predictably, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda have quickly moved back in. The issue that faced us in 2002 was whether Saddam Hussein presented such a dire and imminent threat to the United States that we would be justified in acting under the generally accepted understanding of Article 51 of the UN Charter, which reserves to states the right to act in self-defense. Because he did not present such a threat, the United States should not have sought to precipitate an immediate confrontation, to find a cause for war, and to launch an attack. There is no international law that can ever prevent us from taking action to protect our vital interests when it is manifestly clear that there is a choice to be made between law and our survival. Indeed, international law itself recognizes that such choices remain within the purview of all nations. I believe, however, that such a choice was not present in the case of Iraq. Iraq was not an imminent threat. So our decision to launch an invasion was not justified by the general understanding of international law. But this administration actually seems to prefer to exist outside the realm of international law. In fact, the Bush administration seems opposed to almost any international treaty, not just the Kyoto Protocol, regardless of how much it would help our national security or how little it would limit our foreign policy decision-making. When it comes to treaties, this White House is always ready to acknowledge the cost without ever considering the benefit. For example, the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty was an effort to strike a bargain between states possessing nuclear weapons and all the others who had pledged to refrain from developing them. Of course, we haven't tested a nuclear weapon in over 15 years, and we had no plans for nuclear testing when we negotiated the CTBT. So actually, the treaty didn't require us to give up anything. In exchange for our non-policy change, we could have helped build an international coalition of countries committed to stopping others like North Korea from testing nuclear weapons. The internationally renowned weapons inspector Hans Blix has stated publicly, "No single measure would today give greater encouragement to global arms control than an acceptance by all states of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty that was adopted in 1996. But this administration has rejected the CTBT and now, incredibly, wants to embark on a program to build a new generation of smaller nuclear bombs to use to destroy underground bunkers. We already have both the most advanced nuclear bunker busters of any country and conventional weapons that could destroy most enemy bunkers. So again, the cost of not developing these weapons is small. But in my opinion, new nuclear testing would be utter madness. If we did start testing, our allies and, more important, states hostile to our interest would have an incentive to conduct their own nuclear tests. As we rush to build a new generation of nuclear weapons, China, Russia, India, Pakistan, and others would feel pressure to keep up with us, and this would cause countries around the world to feel the keen need to develop their own nuclear weapons. We might find ourselves in a world in which new states join the nuclear club much faster than in the last few decades." The Bush White House announced in 2002 that, for the first time, the United States was making it a part of our deterrence strategy to consider using nuclear weapons in a first-strike attack against non-nuclear states. This radical and reckless doctrine of nuclear preemption actually creates an incentive for other nations to develop nuclear weapons as quickly as possible so they can respond if America does launch a first strike, an active possibility according to the Bush team. Their policy, enacted in the classified Nuclear Posture Review, has drawn sharp criticism from leading experts in arms control. Arguably, the administration's failure to stop North Korea and Iran from moving forward in their efforts to build nuclear weapons arsenals could be seen by future historians as the worst mistake of all. Another example of the administration's failed non-proliferation strategy is its disregard for the foundation of multilateral nuclear arms control, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Over 180 countries have signed the NPT, and since it entered into force in 1970, it has arguably been the most useful tool in slowing the spread of nuclear weapons. Many credit the NPT regime for pressuring countries like Egypt, Argentina, South Africa, and Ukraine to give up their nuclear weapons programs. The NPT unites the international community in its efforts to discourage states from developing nuclear weapons. Unfortunately, the Bush administration has seriously damaged our perceived commitment to the NPT through policies like its attempted nuclear deal with India, its proliferation security initiative, its disregard for the CTBT, and its disastrous approach to space weapons. Bush's weakening of the non-proliferation regime has been matched by his consistent failure to secure the loose nuclear material that would be the most likely source of a terrorist nuclear strike on the United States. Graham Allison, an expert on loose nuclear material and professor at Harvard, makes the case that preventing nuclear terrorism is actually possible, and all that it requires is understanding a basic matter of physics. Without fissile material, you can't have a nuclear bomb. No nuclear bomb, no nuclear terrorism. Allison argues that we should adopt a strategy of global cooperation, especially with Russia, to contain loose nuclear material, to deny dangerous states and terrorist groups access to fissile material. How does Allison view the Bush administration's efforts in this regard? He concluded in 2004, "The list of actions not taken by the administration remains lengthy and worrisome. Bush has not made nuclear terrorism a personal priority for himself or those who report directly to him. And he has resisted proposals by Senator Richard Lugar, Republican Indiana, former Senator Sam Nunn, Democrat Georgia, and others to assign responsibility for the issue to a single individual who could then be held accountable. As a result, were the president today to ask his cabinet who is responsible for preventing nuclear terrorism, either a dozen people would raise their hands or no one would. Bush has also not communicated his sense of urgency about nuclear terrorism to the presidents of Russia or Pakistan. Nor has Bush increased the pace of U.S. cooperation with Russia in securing former Soviet nuclear weapons and materials. As a result, after a decade of effort, half of the Soviet arsenal remains inadequately secured. Moreover, Bush has demonstrated a willingness to disregard the most important treaties relating to space, and this has made the world significantly less secure. In 1967, America and other nations codified the protection of the peaceful and commercial use of space in the Outer Space Treaty. This commitment reflected the practical desire of all countries to avoid an arms race in space that could disrupt the scientific discoveries made possible by space exploration and the growth in communications and commerce made possible by the launch of satellites. But the Outer Space Treaty also stood for something more than a practical approach to the exploitation of space. It reflected the understanding that space is a common frontier for our entire species and that every nation has the right to experience the wonder and transcendence made possible by space exploration. The 1972 Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, signed during the height of the Cold War, reflected the same spirit. Among the many provisions of this important agreement was a restriction against space-based missile defense systems. This agreement was based on the understanding between the two rival powers that an arms race in space was in neither country's interest. But President Bush's policy decisions appear to violate the ABM treaty, and he seems ready to violate the Outer Space Treaty. The administration's statement of space policy, declared in 2006, is in line with its fundamental view of America's security. Security requires overall military dominance, in the administration's view, up to and including a level sufficient to inhibit competitors from even making the effort to challenge us. A corollary of this approach is antagonism to arms control or other international constraints on the development or use of military power as a potential impediment to the maintenance of American military advantage. Abrogation of the ABM treaty was a demonstration of this administration's preference not to be encumbered by agreements. The doctrine of preemptive strikes against potential enemies, as opposed to a last resort action to deal with imminent threat, fits naturally into this construct. The administration has denied that its statement of policy was intended to portend development of space-based weapons. However, it is clear that figures such as former Defense Secretary Rumsfeld were very much in favor of such an approach. And the logic of the doctrine, as written, clearly points toward the conclusion that the administration believes America should be in a position to deny other nations access to space if that is what is needed to protect U.S. strategic assets located there. As a result, the international community is strongly inclined to view the administration's policy as the foundation for an American effort to unilaterally and permanently dominate space as a medium of combat. No other major state is likely to accept the Bush space policy as permanently acceptable. The administration's shocked response to China's recent test of an anti-satellite ASAT system is an example of America's attitude that its predilections are substitutes for international law. It would be a nice world for us if we could make our desires stick. Experience suggests, however, that in the longer term, we would be wiser to work with others collectively to reduce the risk that we will make outer space a militarized theater of operations. In addition to the reasonable concern that any effort to militarize space will encourage other countries to do the same, there is the ironic fact that these weapons and defensive systems are unlikely to make us more secure. There is little credible evidence that space-based weapons or defenses are effective at stopping any attack on our country, be it a terrorist strike or a missile launch from another nation. If we did manage to develop an effective defense system, it would only encourage other countries and terrorist groups to try to develop ways of getting around the system, either through advanced technological countermeasures or through alternative tactics like suitcase bombs. It is also ironic that this administration, which has expressed concern about the possibility of terrorist biological weapons, has been unwilling to endorse any new verification measures to support the Biological Weapons Convention. To be fair, President Bush has recommended some steps to strengthen the BWC, and at times he seems almost to support its existence. But most experts agree that without inspection provisions, it will be impossible for countries to enforce this agreement and ensure the destruction of biological weapons stockpiles. After rejecting the international community's inspection plan, President Bush did not offer any alternative verification program. Bush has also sabotaged the International Criminal Court. I agree with some of the Bush administration's concerns regarding the relevant treaty as it currently stands and how it would affect our men and women in uniform. But I have learned that rather than just abandoning the international dialogue when other countries don't immediately accept our position, as Bush did with the ICC, we have a better chance of getting our way and leading the world to an agreement that benefits our national security and global security by staying involved in the process and trusting that in the international arena, all nations can come together to use reason and logic to craft the best compromise. But perhaps we shouldn't be surprised that Bush did not want to work to create an international court to handle war crimes because, as I described earlier, He has done everything possible to create an atmosphere of legal ambiguity surrounding the question of whether Americans in uniform can legally use interrogation techniques that clearly amount to torture. He has urged the Congress to make America the first country to repudiate the Geneva Conventions, the international agreement supported by almost 190 countries for half a century that prohibits outrages upon personal dignity, in particular, humiliating and degrading treatment. As noted in Chapter 5, the Geneva Conventions protect our service members. If our brave men and women in uniform are captured, they know that they are protected by international law if they choose not to answer any strategic questions. However, if the U.S. military begins to torture its captives with impunity, our troops will have to learn to expect the same treatment if they are captured. In my religious tradition, I have been taught in the book of Matthew, "Ye shall know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes of thorns or figs of thistle? Even so, every good tree bringeth forth good fruit, but a corrupt tree bringeth forth evil fruit. Wherefore, by their fruits ye shall know them." The president convinced a majority of the country that Saddam Hussein was responsible for attacking us on 9/11, when in truth he had nothing to do with it. Bush planted the seeds of war and harvested a whirlwind. The corrupt tree of this war, waged on false premises, has brought us the evil fruit of Americans torturing and sexually humiliating prisoners who are helpless in their care. In the immediate aftermath of September 11th, we had an enormous reservoir of goodwill and sympathy from all over the world that has been squandered and replaced with great anxiety all around the world, not primarily about what the terrorist networks might do, but about what we might do. My point is not that other nations are right to feel that way, but that they do feel that way. Squandering all that goodwill and replacing it with anxiety is similar to what was done in turning a projected $5 trillion surplus into a projected cumulative deficit of $4 trillion. Officials within the administration have suggested that the war on terrorism may last for the rest of our lives. I think I know what they meant by that, but the apprehensions in the world are not eased by the doctrine of preemption that was asserted by Bush. By now, the administration may have begun to realize that national and international cohesion are indeed strategic assets. But it is a lesson long delayed and clearly not uniformly and consistently accepted by senior members of the cabinet. From the outset, the administration has operated in a manner calculated to please the portion of its base that occupies the far right, at the expense of solidarity among all Americans and between our country and our allies. The gross violations of human rights authorized by Bush at Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo Bay, and dozens of other locations around the world have seriously damaged U.S. moral authority and delegitimized U.S. efforts to continue promoting human rights. As one analyst, James Zogby, put it, "Once we set a high standard for the world, now we have lowered the bar." Our moral authority is, after all, our greatest source of enduring strength in the world. The handling of prisoners at Guantanamo has been particularly harmful to America's image. Even the nations that are arguably our closest allies, England and Australia, have criticized our departure from international law, particularly the Geneva Conventions. Our handling of captives there has been about as thoughtful as Rumsfeld's post-war plan for Iraq. Indeed, many of our traditional allies have been shocked by these new practices. The British ambassador to Uzbekistan, a nation with one of the worst reputations for torture, registered a complaint to his home office about the senselessness and cruelty of the new U.S. practice. "This material is useless. We are selling our souls for dross. It is, in fact, positively harmful." Experts in interrogation have long known that the information gained from torture leads to false confessions and bad intelligence. Even if torture was not morally repugnant and an affront to what America stands for in the world, we should reject it. During the presidency of Ronald Reagan, Secretary of Labor Ray Donovan was accused of corruption. When, after much publicity, the indictment was eventually thrown out by the judge, Donovan asked, "Where do I go to get my reputation back?" President Bush has now placed our whole nation in that same situation. Where do we, the United States of America, go to get our reputation back? And unlike those against Secretary Donovan, many of the accusations against us are not false. One of the most tragic consequences of these official crimes is that it will be very hard for any of us as Americans to effectively stand up for human rights elsewhere and criticize other governments when our policies have resulted in our soldiers' behavior. This administration has shamed America and has deeply damaged the cause of freedom and human rights everywhere, thus undermining the core message of America to the world. The abandonment of the rule of reason by the current administration, in preference for the temptations of raw power, not only creates a sense of strangeness in America, but also creates a disorienting effect for the world as a whole. Without a positive example from the United States, the rest of the world is more likely to move in the wrong direction. For example, the abrupt reversal of progress toward political and economic freedom in Russia might not have occurred had the United States not abandoned its own commitment to these values. President Bush offered a brief and half-hearted apology to the Arab world, but he should make amends to the American people for abandoning the Geneva Conventions and to the United States Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps for sending troops into harm's way while ignoring the best advice of their commanders. Perhaps, most important of all, he owes an explanation to all of those men and women throughout our world who have held high the ideal of the United States as a shining goal to inspire in their land their own efforts to bring about justice and the rule of law. Of course, a sincere apology requires an admission of error and a willingness to accept responsibility and to hold people accountable. President Bush seems to be not only unwilling to acknowledge error, but thus far has seemed unwilling to hold anyone in his administration accountable for the worst strategic and military miscalculations and mistakes in our entire history. Ironically, the administration has had no problem ignoring all of its didactic messages to the world about how democracies don't invade other nations. If we had behaved as a democracy, we would not have invaded Iraq. We can effectively defend ourselves abroad and at home without dimming our core principles. Indeed, our success in defending ourselves depends precisely on not giving up what we stand for. Our top priority should be preserving what America represents and stands for in the world and winning the war against terrorism first. The Bush White House has asked us to concentrate exclusively on this threat. Tragically, however, they completely failed to protect us against the worst terrorist attack in American history. Most Americans have tended naturally to give the Bush-Cheney administration the benefit of the doubt when it came to its failure to take action in advance of 9/11 to guard against an attack. After all, everyone knows from experience that hindsight casts a harsh light on mistakes that should have been visible at the time they were made. But now, years later, with the benefit of investigations that have been made public, it is no longer clear that the administration deserves this act of political grace from the American people. It is useful and important to examine the warnings that the administration ignored, not to point the finger of blame, but in order to better determine how our country can avoid such mistakes in the future. When leaders are not held accountable for serious mistakes, they and their successors are more likely to repeat those mistakes. In the last chapter, I documented how the information that might possibly have been used to prevent the attacks of 9/11 was available at the time, and how that information was ignored by the Bush administration. I do not for one second believe they intentionally ignored it with the awareness that it would enhance the odds of a successful terrorist attack. Of course not. Instead, I believe they ignored the data because of their unjustified tendency to assume that they already knew everything they needed to know, and thus had no need to react with alarm to the warnings of experts and government professionals. Their behavior, in my opinion, was reckless, but the explanation for it lies in hubris, not in some bizarre conspiracy theory. For example, we now know from his testimony to the 9/11 Commission that acting FBI Director Thomas J. Pickard was repeatedly asking the chief law enforcement officer appointed by President Bush to be in charge of counterterrorism, John Ashcroft, to pay attention to the many warning signs that were being picked up by the FBI throughout the summer of 2001. Pickard testified under oath that Ashcroft angrily told him he did not want to hear this information anymore and that Ashcroft shut down the discussion. Ashcroft denied his accusation in his testimony to the 9/11 Commission. It is worth remembering that among these reports that Ashcroft ordered the FBI not to show him anymore was an expression of alarm in one field office that the nation ought immediately to check on the possibility that Osama bin Laden was having people trained in commercial flight schools around the United States. At the same time, an FBI field agent emailed his supervisors on August 19, 2001, that flight school attendee Zacharias Moussaoui was an Islamic extremist preparing for some future act in furtherance of radical fundamentalist goals. The CIA was also picking up unprecedented warnings that an attack on the United States by Al-Qaeda was imminent. Indeed, George Tenet wrote that the entire warning system was blinking red. We also know from Bob Woodward's reporting and from confirming evidence that CIA head George Tenet was frantically trying to communicate the same warnings in June and July 2001 to Bush's National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, and that he was blown off. These affirmative and repeated refusals to listen to clear warnings constitute behavior that goes beyond simple negligence. At a minimum, it represents a reckless disregard for the safety of the American people. Of course, it was in the same time frame, after all the other blinking red warnings had been not only ignored but angrily dismissed, that the president himself was personally presented with a CIA report that carried a headline more alarming and more pointed than any I saw in 8 years of 6 days-a-week CIA briefings. Bin Laden determined to strike in U.S. The only warnings of this nature that I recall remotely resembling the one given to George Bush were about the so-called millennium threats predicted for the end of the year 1999 and somewhat less specific warnings about the dangers that might face the Olympics in Atlanta in 1996. In both cases, these warnings in the president's daily brief, PDB, were followed immediately on the same day by the beginning of urgent daily meetings in the White House with representatives from the agencies and offices involved in preparing our nation to prevent the threatened attack. I personally participated in and sometimes convened and chaired these meetings, and neither President Clinton nor I felt that we were going above and beyond our duties to the nation. These meetings were simply based on a common sense response to dire warnings of the kind that any police chief in America would recognize as part of the job. It is what any reasonable person would do in a similar situation if responsibility were his or hers. By contrast, when President Bush received this fateful and historic PDB, he did not convene the National Security Council. He did not bring together the FBI and CIA and other agencies with responsibility to protect the nation. He did not even ask follow-up questions about the warning. He did, however, dismiss his CIA briefer with a comment. "All right, you've covered your ass now," Bush said, according to journalist Ron Suskind. The bipartisan 9/11 Commission summarized in its unanimous report what happened. "We have found no indication of any further discussion before September 11th between the president and his advisors about the possibility of a threat of Al-Qaeda attack in the United States." The commissioners went on to report that in spite of all the warnings to different parts of the administration, the nation's domestic agencies never mobilized in response to the threat. They did not have direction and did not have a plan to institute. The borders were not hardened. Transportation systems were not fortified. Electronic surveillance was not targeted against a domestic threat. State and local law authorities were not marshaled to augment the FBI's efforts. The public was not warned. Terrorism has actually been on the rise. It is true that we have not suffered another terrorist attack inside the United States since September 11, 2001, and it is only fair to assume that one of the reasons has to do with the many changes the President and the Congress have made in the aftermath of the attack. However, in April 2006, the National Counterterrorism Center released its annual State Department Country Reports on Terrorism. It showed that terrorist attacks worldwide increased nearly fourfold in 2005. 6 months later, in September, a series of leaks forced Bush to release portions of the National Intelligence Estimate that painted just how grim the terror picture had become. The Iraqi Jihad is shaping a new generation of terrorist leaders and operatives, the report read. Perceived jihadist success there would inspire more fighters to continue the struggle elsewhere. If this trend continues, threats to U.S. interests at home and abroad will become more diverse, leading to increasing attacks worldwide. There was then, there is now, and there would always have been, regardless of what President Bush did, a threat of terrorism that we would have to deal with. But instead of making it better, he has made it worse. We are less safe because of his policy. He has created more anger and righteous indignation against us than any leader of our country in all the years of our existence as a nation. Part of the explanation for the increased difficulty in gaining cooperation in fighting terrorism is Bush's attitude of contempt for any person, institution, or nation that disagrees with him. He has exposed Americans abroad and Americans in every U.S. town and city to a greater danger of attack because of his arrogance and willfulness, in particular his insistence upon stirring up a hornet's nest in Iraq. Compounding the problem, he has regularly insulted the religion, the culture, and the tradition of people in other countries throughout the Muslim world. He has also pursued policies that have resulted in the deaths of thousands of innocent men, women, and children, all of it done in our name. President Bush has said repeatedly that the war in Iraq is the central front in the war on terror. It was not, of course, the central front, but it has unfortunately become the central recruiting office for terrorists. The unpleasant truth is that President Bush's failed policies in both Iraq and Afghanistan have made the world a far more dangerous place. It is unfortunate, but it is true. The International Institute for Strategic Studies reported, "The Iraq conflict has arguably focused the energies and resources of Al-Qaeda and bin Laden's followers while diluting those of the Global Counterterrorism Coalition." The IISS said that in the wake of the war on Iraq, Al-Qaeda now has more than 18,000 potential terrorists scattered around the world. Our friends in the Middle East, including most prominently Israel, have been placed in greater danger because of the policy blunders and sheer incompetence with which the civilian Pentagon officials have conducted this war. The prestigious Jaffe think tank in Israel released a devastating indictment of how this misadventure in Iraq has been a deadly distraction from the crucial war on terror. This report has been corroborated and supported by similar studies from the United States and around the world. It is nearly a consensus view. The war in Iraq has become a recruiting bonanza for terrorists who use it as their most damning indictment of the United States and of U.S. policy. The massive casualties suffered by civilians in Iraq, shown routinely and constantly on Arab television stations throughout the Middle East, have been a propaganda victory for Osama bin Laden beyond his wildest dreams. This is tragic, and it was avoidable. The Iraq war plan was incompetent in its rejection of advice from military professionals, and the analysis of the intelligence was incompetent in its conclusion that our soldiers would be welcomed with garlands of flowers and cheering crowds. That mistaken assumption was one of the reasons the Pentagon did not respect the so-called Powell Doctrine of using overwhelming force. Luckily, there was a high level of competence on the part of our men and women in uniform, even though they were denied the tools and the numbers they needed for their mission. But what a disgrace that their families have had to hold bake sales to buy discarded Kevlar vests so the troops can stuff them into the floorboards inside the Humvees they often have to ride around in without adequate armor. Bake sales for body armor. What kind of policy is that? In early 2007, the Secretary of the Army, Francis Harvey, was forced to resign because of the squalor, bureaucratic chaos, and insensitivity with which wounded U.S. veterans of the Iraq War were being treated at Walter Reed Military Hospital. Even though some in the administration had apparently known of the scandalous conditions for months, nothing was done until the Washington Post printed a series of major investigative stories. General Joseph Hoar, former head of the U.S. Marine Corps, told Congress, "I believe we are absolutely on the brink of failure. We are looking into the abyss." When a senior military leader like Joe Hoar uses the word abyss, then the rest of us had better sit up and listen. Here's what he means. More American servicemen and women dying, Iraq slipping into more chaos and violence, no end in sight, with America's influence and moral authority seriously damaged. Retired U.S. Marine Corps General Anthony Zinni, the former four-star general in charge of Central Command, said recently that our nation's current course in Iraq is headed over Niagara Falls. Zinni, named by President Bush as his personal emissary to the Middle East in 2001, offered this view of the situation in a recent book. "In the lead-up to the Iraq War and its later conduct, I saw, at a minimum, true dereliction, negligence, and irresponsibility. At worst, lying, incompetence, and corruption. False rationales presented as a justification. A flawed strategy, lack of planning, the unnecessary alienation of our allies, the underestimation of the task, the unnecessary distraction from real threats, and the unbearable strain dumped on our overstretched military. All of these caused me to speak out, and I was called a traitor and a turncoat by civilian Pentagon officials." I remember watching White House spokesman Dan Bartlett being asked on television about these scathing condemnations by generals involved in the highest levels of the Pentagon, and he dismissed them because they came from retired military officials. But then, even active duty military officers began speaking out against President Bush's policy. For example, a senior general at the Pentagon was quoted as saying, "The current office of the Secretary of Defense refused to listen or adhere to military advice." The commander of the 82nd Airborne Division, Major General Charles Swanick Jr., was asked whether he believed the United States was losing the war in Iraq. "I think, strategically, we are," he said. Colonel Paul Hughes, who directed strategic planning for the Occupation Authority in Baghdad, compared what he saw in Iraq with what happened in the Vietnam War, where he lost his brother. "I promised myself, when I came on active duty," he said, "that I would do everything in my power to prevent that from happening again." He noted the pattern in Vietnam of winning battles but losing the war. Hughes added, "Unless we ensure that we have coherence in our policies, we will lose strategically." Another general said, "Like a lot of senior Army guys, I'm quite angry with Rumsfeld and the rest of the administration." He listed two reasons. He said, "I think they're going to break the Army." And he said what really gets him mad is, "I don't think they care."